Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this time we're spending our precious moments trying to reimagine the sound of 18th century Dublin, which of course means much more than listening for echoes of the Alleluia chorus. And a little later on we'll be imagining an alcohol-free Ireland. But as I said, we begin with a journey into HIP, or is that early music, or original instruments. Peter Whelan, the artistic director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, has begun a project to find and play the neglected music of Ireland from the 17th and 18th century. This week, the orchestra was rehearsing at the NCH for their concert of Dublin-inspired music this coming Saturday, in breaks from which we spoke to Peter Whelan about the future of the past and his own journey into ancient sound.
I remember that maybe the first historically informed performance I heard was probably on Lyric, or what it was called, back in the day. And there were certain programmes which I kind of taped off the radio, which I probably shouldn't have done. But I remember being really excited by the sound of certain recordings that I heard there, kind of begging my parents as a Christmas present to buy certain CDs. And I just remember the excitement of one particular recording of the Brandenburg Concertos by Musica Antiqua Köln, and going into... it was Arnott's used to have a CD store back in the day. And getting this particular music. The sound was a completely different world. I think I must have had some recordings with kind of modern instruments of the Brandenburg Concertos, and this just made sense. It kind of popped out of the speakers, and it just felt really fresh. In fact, it's quite a controversial recording, the Musica Antiqua Köln ones. They're very highly edited, and they're kind of they use all the latest technology in Germany at the time. So it feels really souped up and very dynamic. It's controversial. Some people think it's way too fast, and it's a very extreme version. But as a teenager, the kind of raw energy that came out really appealed to me. And then, of course, the journey began into trying to discover more about these instruments. It was hard in Ireland to find, you know, people who were playing these instruments, or how to even begin. I was playing piano at the time, studying with Valerie Walker, and then Gillian Smith, of course, is a harpsichordist. But the scene was particularly small in Ireland, and of course, you have to do your feiscioles and your normal exams. And it wasn't really until I finished studying. I did a degree in Trinity. Of course, I kind of lapped up lots of recordings, but it wasn't until after that that I went off to Basel, which is one of the homes of kind of early music. And there I met so many people from all over Europe, and there's a huge culture there of early music. I bought my first Baroque bassoon from a woman called Deirdre Nier in Cork, and so she had a beautiful Baroque bassoon, and I remember the day I went down to collect it from her, and she had been a player for years but felt a bit guilty about it sitting around, and I just remember it was the most wonderful thing. I just needed to find people to play it with, and it took a little bit of time. You have to kind of adjust your brain to play earlier instruments. It looks very familiar, but it's a much simpler version in many ways. It's kind of like getting back to basics with any particular instrument. Yeah, but so it took a little while to get going with that and to find my niche. There was a thing called the European Youth Orchestra, European Union Baroque Orchestra, rather, which was really seminal in getting me started playing with other people.
Well, what is your preferred term here? Because there is a load of ways of describing historically informed, historical, original, and then Baroque is a word that covers your particular area. What are the kind of relative merits of those terms?
A term you come across a lot nowadays is HIP, which I suppose is historically informed performance or historically inspired performance. It depends which way you want to look at it. I quite like the historically inspired performance idea because it kind of takes away some of the dryness, you know, of the topic. I think it can seem a bit prohibitive to people from outside, or overly academic. for the first 10 years of the movement, I suppose, from like David Munro and people kind of discovering, rediscovering all of these wonderful old instruments after the Second World War, I suppose it was a little kind of move back to try and find a new way or where we came from, especially after the kind of desolation in Europe of so much concrete and the way that people rebuilt things, quite a brutalist time, that they were looking for something that went further back or had maybe a little bit more European soul. So that was a very exciting moment. People were kind of dusting off these old instruments for the first time and rediscovering the new sounds. Even composers like Hindemith was really interested, and Stravinsky had really interest in this kind of older music and kind of making a renaissance of these new and different sounds. 20, 30 years after that, the movement became a little bit more formulaic. And it was more about what you shouldn't do rather than what you should do. And there was, of course, lots of money for recordings at that time, and people kept pumping them out. At the very beginning, people doing the early music movement were often the people doing contemporary music at the same time. So it was kind of interested and sort of slightly hippie and out there musicians who were involved. But it became quite mainstream. Today it's the same, so you have your symphony orchestras and you have your early music orchestras, say the typical ones who might play Handel or Bach, but it's a very recognisable style and it's definitely not revolutionary anymore. Just within my generation, we're kind of moving on again, In that there's other ways we can find inspiration from the past. For instance, it's not just the books written about how we should play. If you have to sit down and write a book about exactly how, for instance, Mariah Carey does her ornaments, it would take away a lot of the joy out of it. But if we're to look at poetry, pictures, paintings, or read newspaper articles about people, which is the case of these Irish musicians that I'm following, and kind of mix it into the culture and the architecture and the general feel of a place and time, then I think you have a more interesting product on lots of levels. There's a challenge when it comes to programming Baroque music. We have absolutely wonderful music by Bach and Handel, which needs to be heard all the time. It's some of the best music in the world. The danger is that we become limited to this and audiences only want to hear this kind of music again and again. Like the classical music repertoire, for instance, you know, you want to hear your Beethoven symphonies or your Brahms cycles or your Mahler. Firstly speaking, I always found it more interesting to search around the edges. There's plenty of wonderful music that never really gets a look in. I spent quite a few years recording some of these more unusual works. I've explored some music by Zelenka, a very interesting Czech composer, Fasch, who's an unknown German composer. This is all the time when I was doing mostly bassoon. And there were a few others. And then my attention kind of turned back to home, to Dublin and what was going on here. I'd always had this fascination since I was a child about Messiah being performed in Dublin and that iconic gable on Fishamble Street. It just kind of got my imagination going, what was going on there in 1742. Just as we discovered more about the backstory to Messiah, this project going to explore what was going on in the world of music in Dublin at the time. So we're going to feature some music that would have been played in the theatres, including some excerpts from The Island Princess, which was the first semi-stage opera to be performed in Dublin. We were really interested to find out more about it. We found some dance numbers that were performed. But it was really surprising to see how bawdy they are. Like, they're very beautiful music, but some of the titles are really shocking to our ears nowadays and totally unpolitically correct. So you'd have no idea what you're listening to. It sounds like beautiful, sprightly dances, but the names are... The context within the opera are all we're afraid to even write them in the program notes, but kind of very sexy and bawdy themes. the audience's taste back then were I think you're kind of closer in Smock Alley Theatre. You're closer to Copperface Jacks as you will be nowadays than the Cathedral.
I'm guessing that one of the things that's very distinctive about the way you work and the way people working in historically informed performance work is this sort of close alliance with academic musicologists. Because somebody is at the coal face and maybe you're shoveling the coal into the engine. Maybe, is that a useful analogy? How does that relationship work?
The relationship between the performers and academia is extremely important, but there's a big split between the two worlds at the moment. I think academia is so far ahead and so specialised in their areas of research, and there's a kind of a disconnect with, or traditionally has been a disconnect with the performance world. I think that's part of the job description with Irish Baroque Orchestra, is making connections with these academics and kind of joining the dots, because the music doesn't come alive really until people are playing it and there's an audience to listen to it. And this is very gratifying for the musicologists and for the musicians. It's a very kind of healthy relationship between the two. It seems that in academia that the people are becoming more and more specialised in different areas, and that might mean they're kind of becoming more disconnected from a central area. For the future, it'd be nice to see a kind of a space where those two could come together, seemingly worlds apart, but there's so much in common. There's been some interesting connections with musicologists. The first connection I made was with the Kusser project. Kusser was an amazing Hungarian-born musician who ended up in Dublin via everywhere. He studied in Versailles and then he was in London. I think he arrived in Ireland in the early 1700s. He's a fascinating character because he has a little diary belonging to him called his Commonplace Book, which is like a few hundred pages of details about life across Europe, and especially about Dublin, which is totally unheard of. It's a little book that would have fit into his pocket, and is full of the addresses of musicians in Dublin, little potions and spells, you know, remedies, how to cure hangovers, how to cure warts, piles, the works. It's all in there. Also, how to get to London, how long it would take, how to book a theatre, the dimensions, what doors you'd have to lock in King's Hospital so the students wouldn't burst in and get free seats. Really fascinating details. And I remember getting really interested in this, and there's a Kiwi musicologist called Sam Owens. I remember just writing to her, I was playing bassoon at the time, and saying, oh, do you think there's any music by Kusser for bassoon that I could discover a bit more about, you know, the kind of what was going on in Dublin at the time. And she said, well, there's a couple of things in this piece. You know, I found one of the Odes for Dublin Castle by Kusser, which I didn't know existed before. And it was like I of course read about these composers in relation to Dublin, but there was always no music attached to them. So it's just kind of a coincidence. And that was kind of that got me started with directing. I said, well, nobody else is going to do this music, so I'm going to, you know, throw myself into it and try it myself, get some friends together, you know, use the harpsichord, do it the right way around. And we did put on a little concert in Dublin Castle where we recreated this piece. There was such a buzz around it for the musicians as well, that, you know, you're reuniting this music with the correct location, the correct country. And it was really, really good music. And there was so much to discover about it. It was like, it was clear he was trying to introduce, you know, French sophistication to the Irish court. That's kind of a different side of things.
sad, kind of slow ending, maybe long.
It's really interesting to finally get to work with Purcell. I've been doing lots of Handel and some Bach recently. So just going back a little bit further, there was one Irish musicologist in the early 1900s who insisted that, you know, Purcell has an Irish connection, but refused to give any concrete details. So it's difficult to find a connection. But there were Purcells in I think it's called Lochmoe Castle, I think it's in Tipperary, and one of them had a son called Henry, who headed off to London, and then his son Henry was at the Chapel Royal in London. So there could be a connection there, but it's just difficult to prove. It's quite a common Irish name. It does occur in the UK a little bit, but not nearly so much. Purcell collaborated with Nahum Tate as a librettist for much of his life. And the concert we're going to be doing with the Irish Baroque Orchestra in this coming week kind of focuses on the connection between the two men. Nahum Tate is a fascinating character. He seems to be a kind of a polymath. He dabbled with, you know, Shakespeare, and of course he was the poet laureate. Some people are quite critical of some of the libretti he wrote for Purcell, especially one of the pieces we're doing, which is this ode for the centenary of Trinity College Dublin. And people say he it's a bit of hack work. He wrote a little bit too quickly, but I think if you look inside birthday cards nowadays, you'll find similar rubbish inside, and people don't seem to have such a problem with it. The music is great. There's some great mentions of the Liffey, the Boyne, the Shannon musical word painting of I can't think of any other piece that has like the musical representations of Irish rivers, where geographical features get a shout out from such a famous composer. There's an enormous amount of information about these people that's been overlooked, and it's just a huge pleasure, I suppose, a personal pleasure to kind of discover these characters. The more you read about them, the more you hear the music that they played, the formations that they were in, I just feel really privileged to know their stories, and I feel it's just so important to share this with people. It's something people don't know, and I think they could really invest in this knowledge. Every corner in Dublin I walk across now, I know something about the musical background of this, and it's something we could be really interested in and proud of as well.
Peter Whelan of the Irish Baroque Orchestra there. And Peter and the orchestra start the journey this coming Saturday, January 26th, at Christ Church Cathedral with a programme titled Come Ye Sons of Art. Then they'll tour with the Irish National Opera's production of Gluck's Orfeo Euridice from February the 7th till March the 3rd, and perform music by women composers of the Baroque period in La Donna Barocca, with Sarah Power soprano in Dublin on March the 7th and Clonmel on March the 8th.
Listen back to Culture File or get the podcast at rte.ie/lyricfm.
Well, if 18th century Dublin was cherished for its looseness, the 21st century version of the place has another character in mind. In the capital, an alcohol-free pub, the Virgin Mary, will open next month, and among the alcohol-free tipples on its shelves and in its Boston shakers will be Silk Tree, an Irish-made non-alcoholic spirit. Andrew Oates, half of the husband and wife team behind Silk Tree, came to Culturefile Towers, along with our favourite drinks writer, Tomás Clancy of the Sunday Business Post, to offer a teetotal tasting and reveal how alcohol-free drinking could yet save the rural Irish pub.
We definitely tell the people, taste it naked and see what you think of it. Then you can dress it up with your tonic, your ginger, your soda, whatever you want to do, we'll do it for you. But it's a great liquid to work with for a mixologist.
Even though it's something different that you're doing, I suppose that getting involved with actually making the stuff has to do with a general rising tide of small brewers in Ireland and an increase in the whiskey sector. People had started making, this is even though it's contrary to what you're doing, people had started making a lot more alcohol in Ireland.
Yes, and I suppose you could benchmark Drumshambo Gunpowder as a real wonderful company to brand a product and to build a really good gin on the market there. So we decided to produce or try and develop our own non-alcoholic spirit because we would have tried a competitor. We tried it and bought it and online actually, and we're really, really looking forward to trying it. But when it came, we were a little bit disappointed by what we got from it.
You say non-alcoholic spirits, and people like me who obviously don't have the knowledge of the industry think, well, alcohol is spirits. So how can you have a non-alcoholic spirit? How does that work?
Well, the way we process is we work actually with neutral spirit initially, and we macerate it with our ingredients.
What's a neutral spirit?
A neutral spirit is a spirit that's made from grain barley.
It's ethanol-based?
Yes.
So it is alcoholic to begin with?
Yes, it is alcoholic to begin with. And we put it through a pot distillation process.
So you make a mash like you would for a normal whiskey brewing process. You heat up solid ingredients with this neutral spirit, and then you distill it. Is that the process?
That's mainly the process, yeah.
What comes off should be alcohol, shouldn't it?
Yes, there is alcohol come off, but like whiskies, you would take your first cut, your second cut, and your third cut. So we cut it in a specific way, and then we reduce the alcohol down that particular way. We hold some alcohol in our product. It's less than 0.5% alcohol. So we can come in below less than 0.5 alcohol because of the European laws.
And so then that 0.5 is the carrier for the flavour, is it?
That would be it, yes.
I've been thinking, but how can a spirit be non-alcoholic? It's that it's a microdose, they might say.
Yes.
You're getting those kind of, you're getting your hint of juniper, your touch of a little bit of cinnamon.
Yes. Orange.
Yeah, orange, yeah.
Coarse orange peel.
Yes.
And we use lemon verbena.
Right, okay.
Yes. Use lemon verbena.
One of the things that's happening here in Dublin for the first time, and this seems like an old song, but there is going to be a pub in Dublin which does not serve alcohol. You're going to be in there. Tell us a bit about that as an enterprise.
The Virgin Mary is the name of the pub. It's run by Vaughan Yates and his partners who have Poacher's Irish Tonic. And they know what's happening around the world. They're taking note of the whole movement toward no and low alcohols. And they see what's happening in the UK. And they've looked at the gap here in the Irish market and have given it a shot, and I really take my hat off to them and I admire them for doing it. I think it'll do really, really well because, you know, being in the space of no and low alcohol, I see the demand for it. I see the reactions to people, and I can see a really good future. And there's a huge sea change with people in Ireland, you know, and I wish them well, and Siltree will be prominent in their venue.
How big can this scene get? Can you imagine alcohol consumption in Ireland sort of dwindling away?
Well, if you asked me that 4 years ago, I'd have laughed at you and said, "No, the dwindling of alcohol dwindling will never happen in Ireland." If you had asked me, you know, the smoking ban, for example, didn't really affect the venues, the pubs. We're very good at change here, but our laws at the moment are really crucifying the country pubs and even the city pubs.
So we could have you could essentially have a sort of a very local, specific terroir-driven distillate of the botanicals coming out of each county, if you were thinking about it carefully. Mixologist at work.
I saw a mixologist last night in house actually used CBD oil.
Right.
In a cocktail. We need pubs in the rural setting. We need bars. We need places to socialise for people. The laws don't really allow that for people driving now, and that's fair enough. But a lot of people don't go out. So having these non-alternatives or non-alcoholic drinks that are of really good quality brings people into the bar. Pubs are culturally part of the Irish society, And I love going to a pub still. I don't drink. I love socialising. I love having the fun. And that's no different for anybody else. I think pubs in the city as well need that. But where I see it now is, you know, pubs are originally started for socialising. People would meet in pubs. Pubs culture has come that now you have bouncers on doors to be checked before you go in, because mainly there's a huge amount of substances and alcohol taken, and it's for protection. But I think if you're reducing, or if you're more mindful as to what you're drinking, I think the premises have to actually get behind this whole new category. If they want to survive, they need to stock an array of non-alcoholic wines, spirits, and cocktails for that matter, and present them well and let people know they're doing that, and have it as where non-drinkers and drinkers can socialise together. I think the government maybe could do something for this whole category by reducing maybe the VAT rates on non-alcoholic drinks to make it more reasonable, you know, to make it more attractive, should I say, for the consumer, and to also give back to the industry something that will give them an incentive to carry on and build the future of the Irish pub.
Silk Tree's Andrew Oates, along with the Sunday Business Post drinks critic Tomás Clancy there, tasting sobriety and very much bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more surprisingly plausible alternatives on Monday when we begin the new week of Culture File at 6:05 p.m. in Classic Drive. The Culture File Weekly is back again next Friday just after 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.